Lillian Wald, one of the most consequential women in American history, you've probably never heard of, a founder of Modern Social Work.
So Wald really wanted to just focus on the healthcare piece, but a few years into it, realized that that's insufficient. The residents were coming to her door with a lot more questions than just that. And that's kind of how that social services piece emerged.
That's Paul Kaplan. We talk with him about his biography, Lillian Wald, America's Social and Healthcare Reformer. Then, where you live can determine when you die.
You live in a low-income zip code. You have that 20-year life expectancy drop compared to a neighbor literally 5 miles as the crow flies. They'll be living 20 years longer.
We talk with Susan Bowen in the second part of the show about her book, 20 Years of Life, Why the Poor Die Earlier and How to Challenge Inequity. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Were it not for the wave of immigrants who flooded into our country at the turn of the 20th century, we might not have had school playgrounds and school lunches today. But we do because of a great social reformer, Lillian Wald, who decided to make improving the lives of immigrants her life's work. Some historians call her one of the most influential but least known people of the early 20th century. She founded the Visiting Nurse Service, but realized that to really tackle poverty, the conditions immigrants and their kids lived in needed to change. They needed education, playgrounds, enough food to eat, and sanitation. In treating the whole person, Wald changed the whole notion of social service for the poor. Paul Kaplan's biography, Lillian Wald, America's Social and Healthcare Reformer, explores the life of this inspiring figure. The book is geared toward middle and high school students, but it's a fascinating read for anyone of any age. Paul Kaplan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks. I'm very glad to be here.
So, you know, I used to be a social worker, and in fact, I taught social work at Kent State College for several years. When I got your book, Lillian Wald, America's Great Social and Healthcare Reformer, I was astonished that I had never heard of Lillian Wald, in spite of the fact that she was absolutely central to the creation of the social work field. Why do you think she's so unknown, and how did you get interested in her story?
You know, it's really true. She's very unknown, and I myself had not heard of her just several years ago. I think part of the reason is she was a very much of a behind-the-scenes person. She wasn't out in the forefront, even though what she's known for is the deeds that she accomplished that we have every day, whether it's like the school lunches or the school playgrounds, or most know the Visiting Nurses Service. They just don't know the story of the person who founded it. Now, for me, I first came about her when I wrote another book, which was on Jewish New York, which was a cultural and historic guide. So in doing that book, I researched different historic people in New York City who I thought were interesting to profile. And so I came across her, and I came across the Henry Street settlement, and I thought that it was a really interesting story. So when I started doing book talks on that book, I had a section of my book talks where I talked about individuals, and she was one of the individuals that I profiled. And I noticed that audiences had questions about it, and I thought it was a really interesting story to tell. So I delved in deeper. I learned a lot more about her story and what had been accomplished through all of that, and went to the Henry Street Settlement, went to a lot of the archives, and that was how I really got to know the subject very well and tried to convey that story to a new generation.
Yeah, the Henry Street Settlement, it still exists in New York. It still has programs, as a matter of fact. Why don't we just start there, and then we can go back to her background. How did the Henry Street Settlement get started?
Yeah, so absolutely right. The Henry Street Settlement is thriving. It's still there where it was since the 1890s. And they do a lot of social services programs for whether it's the elderly, whether it's for youth, whether it's for domestic abuse. They have a lot of different programs. And it's been noted by a lot of key politicians who visited, like Hillary Clinton and so on. And they actually just got a very big donation from an individual who was a legal secretary. And she just saved her pennies and invested well. And after she died, she gave them the biggest donation they've ever received, which is in very keeping with the organization because it came from just an individual. So in terms of its beginning, this was part of the Settlement House movement. So if we think back to the progressive era in New York, which is 1890 to 1920, Lillian Wald came to New York. She was a nursing student. She was practicing nursing, and she liked helping the patients. She felt called to do so. She was very, very inspired to do so with the death of her brother, who had drowned. But she found that the field was very bureaucratic. Nurses weren't really well respected. It was all about addressing the symptom and not the cause. And a lot of patients wouldn't even go for treatment because they kind of feared hospitals, and of course many couldn't afford it. And there was very little insurance. So Wald kind of lives in her own bubble as a nursing student. But then, through a set of circumstances, she sees the Lower East Side in the early 1890s. And she, in the book, I talk about how that happens. And this is a real awakening for her. She has this moment of truth and decides that she wants to do something somewhat unusual at the time, which was move in to the Lower East Side. And that is what became a settlement. So she moves into the neighborhood with a fellow nursing student, Mary Brewster, and they live in an apartment where they go out and they service the needs of these very poor and often unhygienic residents and try to improve their lives in many different ways. And they're funded by Jacob Schiff, who is a philanthropist, and that was for 2 years. And he eventually realizes they need a bigger place, and he buys them in the mid-1890s a house on Henry Street, which became the Henry Street Settlement.
And was it before or after the Jane Addams? Jane Addams was the famous person who established Hull House in Chicago?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's interesting. Jane Addams is more well-known today, I would say. It's sort of interesting in history, like how certain players become better known. So Jane Addams had established the Hull House in Chicago. Ironically, though, that no longer exists. Jane Addams and Lillian Wald were good friends, and they exchanged a lot of ideas as well. And there were other settlements before the Henry Street Settlement. It was not the first one. There was, for example, the University Settlement, not far from the Henry Street Settlement. And that exists today, too. The University Settlement is in the Lower East Side. And their emphasis at that time was more on education, whereas for Wald and Henry Street Settlement, it was really more on health care. And then it advanced to be doing a lot of other things, for example, a lot in the arts, which became the Grand Street Playhouse, which is still there today and does a lot of really exciting plays and artistic endeavors.
You've mentioned the Lower East Side now a number of times. Why were the settlements concentrated there? Tell us what the Lower East Side was like back then, and this would have been around the turn of the 20th century.
Right. So, importantly, they did have settlement houses in other places, too, throughout the city of New York and in other places in the country, such as Chicago. Also in the UK, that was an important forebearer of settlement houses as well. The Lower East Side was unique in that, starting in the mid-19th century, you have the huge wave of the so-called second wave of immigration. So that area of Manhattan, the Lower East Side, was part of what was called Klein Deutschland, or Little Germany. A lot of German kind of culture and immigration. Well, by the 1870s, a lot of the Germans tend to move out of that area and to uptown, like the Upper East Side. And you have great waves coming to to the U.S., especially from Southern and Eastern Europe. So you do have a lot. You have more Irish who come in. You have a lot of Italians, some Greeks and Jews, but not Chinese due to the Chinese Exclusion Act. So you have these huge waves of immigrants coming through Ellis Island. Many of them do stay in New York when they go through Ellis Island, and they tended to go to the Lower East Side. Now, that became the most densely packed area in the world. So one way to think about it is like Mumbai, India today. It was extremely crowded, and a lot of that was because of the tenements. So landlords were able to have like these multi-housing units, and a lot of them did not have running water. It was often like six or seven member families, and they would often take in a boarder that were crammed into like these very small spaces. You had a lot of like peddlers on the street kind of selling their wares. So it was a difficult place. There was a lot of different languages being spoken, and there were also some street gangs that emerged. But amidst all this, there were a lot of really interesting things going on, like the settlement houses, like the educational alliance that sprung up. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of really important eateries that served the immigrants, which are still around today. So besides being a difficult place, it kind of had this element of being a interesting educational and social political place. Like, for example, a lot of newspapers were born out of that area, like The Forward.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Paul Kaplan about the great social and healthcare reformer Lillian Wald. She founded the VNA and was a pioneer in bringing playgrounds and school lunches to America's poor children. And we should point out also that you mentioned the Chinese Exclusion Act. You know, a lot of people today say, well, immigrants should come in legally like my forebears did, but in fact, immigration was legal for everybody except Chinese. It was kind of like the Muslim ban today, but nothing else.
Right. That's a great point. And I think it's often not discussed enough. So at that time, immigrating to the U.S. from most countries, but mostly from Southern and Eastern Europe, you would come across the ocean. You would go through Castle Clinton, which is still open to the public in New York, and then that closed, and Ellis Island replaced it as the processing center, partly due to a lot of corruption that occurred at Castle Clinton, and they just didn't have the room. But you would go through Ellis Island. Now, there's no guarantee that you would be admitted, but almost all were. The only times you'd be turned back would be, they actually had a certain code that they had to follow, so there were certain diseases they would look for. Trachoma, eye diseases, tuberculosis. They actually looked for, like, anarchists, which would be very hard for them to determine if you had any, like, quote-unquote political trouble in your that you caused in your home country. But, of course, you know, in reality, it would be very hard to prove any of that, and there was huge language barriers. So most did make it, though there was no guarantee that you would once you came over here. But there was, to your point, there was no... If you were healthy and you had some means of getting here, and once you started here, the chances were very, very good that you would make it in. Right. Whereas today, the laws have changed, so now that you would have to come in like through a whole legal means.
Exactly. So now back to Lillian Wald. Tell us a little bit about her background.
Lillian Wald was from Rochester, New York in the mid-19th century. And remember, Rochester in western New York, that was more of a politically important area at that time in the mid-19th century. You had some of the original women's suffrage movements in Seneca Falls. You have Frederick Douglass and a lot of the speeches that he gave in the 19th century, Emma Goldman, labor reformist. So you kind of have some of this going on in Lillian's background, even as she's growing up. She grows up in a traditional middle-class Jewish family, and her father was involved with ophthalmology, which Rochester was known for, and that's where Bausch & Lomb started. And her mother wanted her to kind of settle down and get married, but Lillian just wasn't comfortable in that life, and she wanted to do something growing up that she thought was going to be very impactful, but she didn't know what that was. And when her brother unexpectedly and very tragically drowned, that had a real impact on her. And she decides she wants to go into healthcare. So she lies about her age, and she applies to different schools, and eventually applies to a nursing school in Manhattan. So that would have been considered very far away from Rochester. You know, I mean, today it's still 7 hours driving. And she comes to New York and gets accepted to the school. And she kind of has this, like, over-exuberance. Like, she tries to really engage patients. She tries to see how the system can be improved. And a lot of these were not welcome by the staff. And it's sort of like, just do your job kind of thing. And she gets disillusioned. And that's where she decides that she wants to do something different. And she also worked at a juvenile asylum. And again, there, I think she felt that the system was very stacked against a lot of these kids. And it was very institutionalized and bureaucratic. And she kind of really started her own, in a way, what we would call today her own social service practice, but without really thinking about it that way. I think that's important. It's not like she said one day, I want to start my own practice. It was more like it happened organically by what she saw, and she maybe noticed some of these other settlements and decided that this was a way for her to do it. And, you know, it's probably also important to point out that would have been really, really, really unusual at that time, especially for a woman, to say, I'm just going to get an apartment in this neighborhood with my roommate, and we're going to try to get a philanthropist to fund us, and we're going to go out and work with a lot of the patients. And, you know, in the book, I talk about how a lot of that happened and some of the funny stories that often ensued around that.
You talk about a class that she taught at this asylum for truant and neglected children and an incident that happened there that changed her. What was that?
So she was teaching this hygiene class, and again, a lot of mostly immigrants, many of whom didn't speak much English, and a little girl burst into the class, couldn't really communicate in English, but Wald knew something was terribly wrong. Little girl goes to Wald, takes her by the hand, and literally drags her throughout this incredibly, again, crowded neighborhood, takes her through all the winding streets, which is a complete eye-opener for Wald. She had no idea, because she was in a whole other part of town and lived in a bubble, as many did and still do. And the child takes her up like these creaking staircases to her apartment. And that is where Wald sees, like in the back on the bed, a woman almost bleeding to death, like hemorrhaging blood. And Wald is, with her nursing skills, able to save her. She was doing so from childbirth. And this is what she calls baptism by fire. And this was a really important moment where she has her eyes open to a lot of the needs of the community. And that's where she decides she really wants to service them, but not just do so from a distance, but to live among them. And that's this part of this idea of the settlement.
You mentioned the nursing, obviously. I mean, this may have been her first visiting nurse visit. Talk about the visiting nurse service and, you know, how she set this up.
So at first, it was all one organization, and it was always one organization of the Visiting Nurse Service and Henry Street Settlement. And that was the case until after Lillian Wald died in 1940. So this organization was to provide the healthcare services, to go to neighbors, to be able to also be proactive and help introduce a lot of hygiene practices, making sure that residents could see that milk had been pasteurized. And in doing so, though, they realized that it wasn't really enough, because it had to address some of the causes. So in a way, it was the start of what we call today public health. Mm. How can they improve that and social services, when that phrase wasn't really used at the time? So looking at, can they offer microloans to some some of the patients that they were serving so they could take off from work, or they could have, they were able to do the economic balance with that. So the social services piece emerged. It wasn't like she started off doing that, but realized that that was a key piece in making change. And another piece to all this was a lot of the labor reform movements that were happening. A lot of these workers were very exploited, and also children were very exploited. And a lot of them worked very, very long hours in very grueling conditions, and were unions were coming about, but they weren't allowed to join them, or there would be a lot of consequences if they did. So Wald really wanted to just focus on the healthcare piece. But a few years into it, realized that that's insufficient. The residents were coming to her door with a lot more questions than just that. And that's kind of how that social services piece emerged. And in the book, I talk about how this jeopardized some of her funders and philanthropists who were not comfortable with, they were comfortable with healthcare, but they weren't comfortable with dealing with some of these economic and worker issues.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Paul Kaplan about his biography, Lillian Wald, America's Great Social and Healthcare Reformer. Yeah, I found that very interesting that they resisted quite a bit organizing for labor rights. It always seems like labor rights gets the short end of the stick. How did she work with this to get funding for the work at the Henry Street Settlement?
So by the same way that she started out, so through her philanthropy from Jacob Schiff, who was an investment banker, he was one of the investment bankers with the original Penn Station, and others whom he introduced her to. Wald is not well known today, but she was very good at certain things besides healthcare, and one of them was networking. She was a great networker and able to convince some business people and wealthy individuals to give money. And she also kept records of what they were accomplishing and what they were trying to do with each patient. So philanthropists liked that there was this accountability. And she also invited some of the philanthropists and their wives to come to the Lower East Side and see some of this. And there's a lot of funny stories in the book about how they did that. But also, importantly, the Visiting Nurses Service and Henry Street Settlement is one organization partnered with the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. And that was able to provide a lot more scale in providing services and what was called industrial insurance to give some kind of coverage for a lot of these residents. And what they were able to do is give out pamphlets in local languages of these different communities. And so the messaging was far more effective about how they could improve their health care and so on. And then with the worker piece, though, some philanthropists wanted to pull out. And they said, we can't support unions. So in certain cases, Lillian Wald said, we'll keep it anonymous. We won't have to make that connection. Because it was, a lot of business people would have seen it as they were supporting unions, which were controversial at the time. And some were considered like trying to start a revolution, which was a fear at the time, or ties to communism or socialism. And these were a lot of the sort of fears of society, and the philanthropists didn't want to be harmed in their name and brand. So Wald tried to work with that.
That's great. I mean, you know, in other words, they kept on giving money as long as it was anonymous, which even that seems more liberal than what might happen today.
And a lot of the donors weren't anonymous, but they were when it came to supporting any of the labor union. They were anonymous when it came to anything that would be deemed controversial, like so that one of their clients or investors wouldn't say, why are you supporting that cause? Maybe I won't do business with you if you support that cause.
Now, this very much is part of her vision that I think, you know, she had a huge influence in the social work profession. She must have, in treating the whole person. A little bit before, Paul Kaplan, you mentioned playgrounds and cultural activities. She was also instrumental in getting the Metropolitan Museum of Art to open up on Sunday?
Right. So part of it goes back to this time, which again, as I mentioned earlier, is the Progressive Era, and it, which now we call from 1890 to 1920. And part of that was about passing these sweeping reforms and having even like leisure activities be more accessible to the public. There was a rising middle class during this time, and it was about having many different museums or parks be accessible. So the Metropolitan Museum of Art, originally downtown, then moved uptown, Wald noted was if it's not open on Sunday, that's when most laborers are available. So if it's closed, it's not going to work. So, you know, the encouragement of and advocating for opening it up on Sunday, for providing transportation, and also to try to make art available to more than just the upper class. And that's part of what she's trying to do as well.
And also she was instrumental in beginning the special education, you know, activities of schools?
Right. That's a whole other thing, is how do you provide education to students with remedial needs? And a lot of that happened from Wald's and other nurses at the settlement, advocacy in schools for having some of these different classes. Part of how she accomplished all this was another hallmark of the Progressive Era, which was about collecting data, showing empirical results, showing why something is effective or ineffective, and she would do that. And then she would basically do a study and show why schools should invest in having different classes for special ed, as an example.
Yeah, that's terrific. And also free school lunch. I mean, I just learned so much from this book that you've written. It's just terrific. And I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice, Paul Kaplan. The book is Lillian Wald, America's Great Social and Healthcare Reformer.
Thanks. Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Kaplan is the author of several books about history and cultural figures, including one about Jewish New York and a biography of Irving Berlin. Next up, why the poor die earlier and what some people are doing to change that. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Studies have shown that your zip code determines your health. People who live in poorer communities die on average 20 years earlier than people who live in wealthier neighborhoods. That's a shocking statistic at the center of Susan Bohan's book, 20 Years of Life. In it, Bohan not only explains the reasons for this health disparity, but also how one bold experiment is working to change it. She shows how the California Endowment, a health foundation, is upending the old-school, top-down charity model and investing $1 billion over 10 years to help distressed communities advocate for their own interests. This new approach to community change draws on the latent political power of residents to drive reform, both locally and in the state's legislature. It's a model that has the potential to work anywhere in the country. Susan Bohan is an award-winning health and science journalist. Her work has appeared in the Sacramento Bee, the LA Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, and other newspapers nationwide. So, Susan Bohan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
This book, 20 Years of Life, Why the Poor Die Earlier and How to Challenge Inequality, it's really the story of a 10-year campaign of a project called Building Healthy Communities. It was part of something that was run by the California Endowment. That's a health foundation that turned to community change initiatives. So tell us, what's a community change initiative? What was different about what they decided to do? And just tell us how this BHC, Building Healthy Communities, got started.
Sure. It's actually still underway, which is exciting. So I'm reporting about 7 years into a 10-year project, and it's working so well that this foundation, the California Endowment, plans to continue it because their board of directors said, why would we stop this since it's working so well in changing policies and systems in these 14 communities that are part of the test? I'll give a quick overview of it. They started in 2010. They chose 14 communities in California, low-income, distressed communities, but which showed signs of promise in terms of local leadership and activism. And they've invested $1 billion into that, or they intend to by the end of the 10 years, which will be 2020, into supporting community organizing, resident empowerment, and aligning the nonprofits that work in the community so that they're really working more in tandem rather than working in separate silos. And so the results have been fantastic. And what it is it's based upon the premise of a community change initiative, which have been around for a few decades, but it's concentrating on not just programs to go into low-income areas to offer nutrition services or exercise or so on, but really changing everything about a community, all the gears that work in the community so that it's improved. And that means changing systems. It's bringing new laws in so that there's more equity in terms of, you know, transportation policy with trucks going through your community and so on. So that's the essence of it. But in the past, these community change initiatives, they were tried by various foundations, but they really didn't get the result they wanted of seeing significant shifts. But what they realized was that they didn't have the long enough duration. Dosage and duration is what the term they use. So they weren't in there long enough, and they weren't spending quite enough money. So most of these have been 2, 3, 4 years, and actually not two, it was 3 to 5 years. And the endowment said, we're doing 10 years, and we're betting the bank on it. We're pretty much, all of our giving is going toward this strategy. So it was a big risk, but it's worked out very well, and I can describe some of the successes and how they measure success.
Yeah, and we will do that. But first, let's take a step backward and give us the context. One of the things that you say in this book, I believe actually somebody else said it, but you repeat it, and that is that your zip code is a greater predictor than your genetic code in determining your health and how long you live. So deconstruct that idea for us.
Yeah, it's something that's gaining a lot of currency. It's interesting. You're hearing it more and more. And, you know, politicians and political, you know, others, leaders mentioning your zip code determines your health. And what it really means is that there's a 20-year life expectancy difference between certain communities, some even larger, actually, in the U.S. and around the world, based upon where you live, which is also, of course, all about your income, where you can afford to live. And so in your genetics account for perhaps 15% of your health outcomes. It's not that strong, 10 to 15% really. And so, but well over half of your health outcomes have to do with lifestyle choices. But lifestyles, and also another 20% or so in terms of access to medical care. It's actually surprisingly small on the access to medical care. So that's about 70%, but what it means is the lifestyle choices that they're trying to address that in these poor communities because they don't have the same option of choices. So you live in a low-income zip code. You have that 20-year life expectancy drop compared to a neighbor literally 5 miles as the crow flies. They'll be living 20 years longer because they have many more amenities that wealthy and middle-class areas take for granted, parks, safe places to walk, good schools, and so on. And on top of that, as I describe in one chapter called The Stress Effect, these places have high levels of chronic stress, from anxiety over finances, fear of crime, just the general stress of being run down by worries and racism in many of these areas, the toll of racism. And it has a profound physiological effect. So that's what they mean by your zip code determines your health.
Right, and you contrast Pacific Palisades and South Central L.A. What are some of the things that Pacific Palisades has that South Central L.A. doesn't?
So much, right? Pacific Palisades is a beautiful community on the coast of L.A., and so the beach is there. There's beautiful hiking trails just right on the edge of town. They have a lovely, safe downtown, very nice schools. And people are comfortable and content there. And you head in just literally perhaps 7 miles direct route to South Central. And it's just, it's run down. They don't have for this vast area, barely had a grocery store. They have one of the big box ones. That's been remedied in significant part because of this California endowment work. But there's also incredible crime rates and, stories of people simply walking down the street and being caught by a stray bullet. No parklands, and the parklands that do exist didn't feel safe for people to use. Schools that were low performing with kids getting kicked out a lot for minor infractions. And so it's just a much more, a stressful environment, and you feel that sense of distress when you drive through it.
And when we're talking about the difference in mortality, we're not just talking about, say, averaging in gun violence. We're also talking about actual disease like diabetes, heart disease, cancer.
Right. Yes. So you're talking, there are higher rates of all of these in these communities. And that's what they do link that heavily to chronic stress, just the toll of all that activating the stress response, the body gets thrown out of into a disequilibrium state. And also there is the issue of access to healthy foods and the ease of getting a simple high fat but fast food meal, high sodium and so on. So the ease of getting those types of foods it's much more prevalent in these low income communities. And so, there's all manner of higher rates of disease. It's consistently borne out in these low-income zip codes compared to, higher, wealthier areas. And the thing is, what's interesting is the middle class is also affected. There's a stair-step pattern of these life expectancy differences by zip code, with the middle income also suffering a loss of life, but not as severe as the lowest income, and also higher rates of disease.
What's so striking, I think, about your book, Suzanne Bowen, about 20 Years of Life, is how it gives a picture of a model that is not top-down, but is, I think as someone says, grassroots to treetops. Explain that.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's really key to this and what has made this initiative particularly unique. What they mean is that you have to, if you're going to drive community change, the community has to really own it. They have to be deeply committed to it and passionate about it. So you don't come in and tell them, we think you need to have this type of program, or you need a better park, or what have you. They go to the community, the California Endowment Leadership did, and they did what are called listening campaigns. And they had the community prioritize what were their highest needs. So out of these 14 communities, the priorities were different, although there were some unifying ones that came out. And there have been just absolutely profound in terms of what they learned by listening to people. They did not have on their radar, for example, that for parents, they were saying their number one wellness issue was that their children were being kicked out of school for minor infractions, ending up on the street, ending up not graduating, and lack of a high school diploma is a 5-year life expectancy loss. Education is profoundly influential on your life expectancy, and that's tied to income as well as just a sense of agency and control in your life. But Bottom line is the parents were saying all over these 14 communities, they were worried about these disproportionate expulsions and suspensions for their kids. And so the California Endowment had never heard of that. It wasn't on their plan in this 10-year community. And they dug deeper and realized it was a major issue. And long story short, there's two chapters that I have in there. And actually, the Stanford Social Innovation Review just yesterday published my synopsis of this school reform campaign. There was a total of 11 laws that have now been passed in California because it's directly tied to this Building Healthy Communities campaign and the resident activism that they promoted and supported. But there's 11 laws keeping kids in K through 12 school, making it much harder to suspend or expel them. And as a result, as I report in the book, last year there were 300,000 fewer suspensions in California schools compared to when the campaign started. And you know that there's more kids graduating and having better lives and healthier lives as a result.
Well, Suzanne Bowen, in your book, 20 Years of Life, you also talk about the vital importance to the health of children of play. And one of the most remarkable chapters in your book is about parks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, The Safe Place to Play is that chapter. And there's a woman, well, actually, there's a few stories in there, but one is about these young people in a neighborhood called City Heights in San Diego that absolutely got fed up with not having a skate park in their community, whereas all around in wealthier areas of San Diego, which is a vast city, they had skate parks. And one of their friends got injured with a vehicle striking him on the sidewalk, and they just got fed up, and they organized to demand a skate park in City Heights. And as I describe in there, they went to more than 100 city meetings, from planning departments and recreation departments to city councils meetings, and demanding a skate park. And this initiative supported them in training. They went to training sessions. They had one called power analysis, so these young people understood how the power structure works in their community and how to respectfully request change. You don't go in and angrily demand it, but you do your research and you're persistent and you're respectful and you're professional. And they so impressed the people on the city staff and the city council that they got more and more allies among adults in the community. And in the end, they have now two skate parks, this huge 19,000-square-foot one, and then that just opened in January. That was a $5 million budget that they got in. The adults, the city leadership got grant funding for that because of these kids' activism. And then a smaller 2,500-square-foot skate park opened a few years earlier.
And the other park is Pogo Park. I went online and I saw, it just looks so beautiful. What a story of transformation. I mean, the power of a park to transform a whole community. Tell us that story.
Yes, Pogo Park is a magnificent story. And Tootie Maher, whom I profile in the book, just decided that she was going to put her resources, she made money in business, and she wanted to take a park in a really rundown area and help kids get out and play, because she knew she's been athletic all her life, and she actually overcame a disability as a kid. So she understood challenges of getting physical activity, but she's fully overcome it. She's quite athletic. But she took this rundown park where men were just there dealing drugs and using drugs, and dogs were, they were practicing dog fights, and the swings were all torn up because they would teach the dogs to clamp onto the swings. And it was, and kids were terrorized going there. The few who did brave it, sometimes they would be up in the jungle gym staying away from the dogs down below who were barking at them. And glass was all over, and she decided to take that on and get the city to support her in transforming it. And she did have an enlightened city manager, whom I also describe in there, who supported her in making these changes. That was really critical. You have to have, you know, city leadership who's willing to work with you to make this happen. But she brought in millions of dollars of grant funding also, and has turned this former decrepit, dangerous park into an absolute jewel of the community. It has a zip line. It has a cafe with inexpensive, healthy food. It's got one play area after another. The most recent innovation was a little artificial creek they created to simulate being sort of in wilderness, so people could just go sit there and be peaceful and relax. They have wonderful playgrounds, a little village of like small homes that mimic homes from around the world, and just on and on, all kinds of, and they staff it. That's what's critical. They have funding to have it, an adult always supervising, and they also hired residents. Tootie had the vision of you have to hire residents to design the park, to build the park. She prayed for training for them in all manner of skills, construction skills, and because they're the ones who look out for it. This is a gang-ridden area, and the gangs completely stay away from it because they know the people who built it. And it's their auntie, for example, who works there. So they're just, it's untouched and it's protected. And on top of that, she has put in hundreds of thousands of dollars of wages into the resident, into the community by hiring local residents to run it. So it's an absolutely transformative model and be wonderful for more communities to look at replicating that to create parks in dangerous areas. And there's now just, it's 70,000 kids a year now visit that, and it's just transformed the neighborhood, most assuredly.
Yeah, and let's point out, these are good jobs with decent pay and benefits.
Correct.
As well. I mean, some people had never had access to health insurance before through their job, and they are now getting it.
Yes.
And, you know, what was also interesting about it is that it has become, it's a community gathering place as well, because this is in Richmond, California, when there was a big gas release several years ago. That's where people went.
Exactly. Yeah. And interestingly, there was a community center just a few blocks away. Nobody showed up there because they didn't feel a connection to that community center. They spent a lot of money building it. Again, when you have the community involved, they own it. They just, so when the Chevron had a major gas explosion and a huge plume of toxic material went out overhead, they all went to Pogo Park for some reason. Nobody anticipated that, but that became the gathering spot for the community to get information and understand where to go, how to get to the hospital if they wanted an evaluation and so forth. So, and now it's become, made it more of a community gathering place for various reasons, because people have just come to love it. So, again, it's just a wonderful example that this can be replicated, but you cannot have, if you have a park in a distressed area, you can't just have the Public Works Department outsource and bring some landscape architect from 50 miles away to come in, redo it, and then leave. It'll just go back to the same condition it was. They took ownership of this park and had the locals, running it and designing it, and it's really become embedded into the community, and it's sustainable.
And so what about the impact on health outcomes? Is there any way to measure that impact?
Yeah, they right now are measuring it in terms of kids, using it and self-reported, assessments of how happy are you living in the neighborhood. People are definitely much more content being in that neighborhood. It's called the Iron Triangle, and it was really been quite a notorious neighborhood. But the property values are actually going up around there a bit because of the park. But they're mostly measuring it in terms of how much kids are reporting more activity than they had before. So it's difficult, of course, to measure health outcomes in a child, but they are reporting definitely more hours of play in the kids living in the area.
And now moving to older kids, there's another really exciting project in Richmond that came under the aegis of the Building Healthy Communities Initiative, and that's the Office of Neighborhood Safety. I mean, it sounds like, you know, a police department, but no, it's not.
Yeah, exactly. It is definitely a bureaucratic name. That is an absolutely magnificent success story. And what happened is there's a very, enlightened leader, an activist, and he's an attorney also, who started Devon Bogan. Richmond had one of the highest homicide rates, you know, per 100,000 in the nation. At some time, I think it was 2007, they were in the top 10. You know, so they just said enough. They have to do a different way of tackling this. So the bottom line is, Devon devised a program, envisioned a program, and implemented it again with the support of this enlightened city leader, the city manager who helped Pogo Park, who agreed to support a city-run program that reached out to the, quote, active shooters, the young men that the police knew and the FBI and so on were the ones out there causing almost all of the gun violence that was terrorizing the community and driving down property values and so forth. And Devon made the case that they are really an economic development. This is an economic development program as well as a safety program, because you reduce violence and everything changes in a community. More businesses come in and so forth. And so he began to reach out with tremendous supports to these young men who were engaged in gun violence. And many of them completely forswore it and have become, quote, peace ambassadors. And rates of gun violence have plummeted 70%.
Wow.
In Richmond since it began. And it was controversial, of course, to look at spending. They were using city resources, of course, because it was a city program. And the California Endowment supported what's called the fellowship program, where they pray for the money for these young men to go into various support programs. And they actually travel so they can get out of this tiny town where they protect tiny bits of turf to their lot with their lives, and get out of town and get a broader perspective of the world. And so the endowment has supported some of those parts of the program that the city would have difficulty justifying, because some people think they're just coddling criminals and they should be in jail. But this is ultimately about creating a safer community and healthier community for everyone.
Yeah, it's a very inspiring model. I mean, these kids have gone from being, you know, on a suicide/murder mm-hmm. path to some of them going to college.
Exactly. Oh, definitely. Yeah, one is getting a master's degree, and he wants to go into criminal reform and, you know, work. So there's just story after story that's quite inspiring of these young men. There's been, of course, not all succeeded. You're not going to have 100% with this. But it's been incredible, and it is replicating. Sacramento just adopted it. The city of Stockton, which has high crime rate, is adopting it. It's most assuredly being replicated, this model, elsewhere, because it's working.
And there's so many other inspiring stories. I mean, we haven't even gotten into a wonderful chapter or even a couple of chapters about the work that's being done in rural communities where there are, you know, poor white and Native American and Latino communities that are also bringing themselves up with this initiative, the Building Healthy Communities. But I have a question for you, and that is, how far can community action go without changing the fundamental institutions of inequality? I mean, lack of unions, lack of jobs, a winners-take-all economy, you know, kind of the structural segregation of the schools, the redlining of neighborhoods. I mean, can just community organizing change the fundamental structures of inequality?
Yeah, well, they're tackling that with this. And what they do is, with this initiative, when they recognize a statewide something of statewide importance. They mobilize. They help mobilize people from all these 14 communities and elsewhere, of course. They get caught up in this to drive more systemic change. And with, in terms of, say, jobs and economic development, that's a big task, but they are tackling that up in the rural area. And in terms of the other examples, you know, racism, I mean, they are tackling that by calling it out with this community organizing. So these are big, huge issues, but community organizing can begin to call it out and bring attention to it. But in terms of economic development, which is really so much of the source of our inequality in this nation, for example, up in the rural community, what they decided to do is concentrate on literacy so that all of their students were graduating high school fully literate, because they realized without that, they couldn't have economic development in the area. And so that's interesting how that, and that's another lesson for all rural areas to look at, is literacy rates. It drills down to such a simple message, but it's very profound. Imagine if you had all high school students graduated reading at 12th grade level, what that would do to drive economic prosperity in those regions.
And then, of course, then there are issues like making college affordable and having living wage jobs. But maybe, you know, I think the lesson that I know I took away from your book is that when you mobilize people and teach them how to act on their own behalf, that's when real fundamental change can happen. And they can go much further than a literacy program.
Yes, and actually you're bringing up the issues you raise are all about who do you put in power, who, you know, the elected officials that you have. And so very much a part of this campaign is voter engagement. So to address some of those other issues that you're raising, that's about citizens being engaged in the political process and voting in politicians who will advance the right kind of policies to, you know, address those issues. So, and in fact, when the 2016 election, California had their Secretary of State, who runs elections, credited this campaign with increased voter turnout. And in California, despite what happened on the national level, we actually had a number of progressive initiatives pass because of higher, on a statewide basis, because of the level of voter engagement that we had in this state.
Well, that's an inspiring note to end this on. Suzanne Bowen, it's just been so great to talk with you about your book, 20 Years of Life, Why the Poor Die Earlier and How to Challenge Inequality.
Thank you so much, Francesca. You have great questions as well.
Suzanne Bowen. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to her award-winning series, Shortened Lives, Where You Live Matters. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.